From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome to the China in the World podcast. Today I'm fortunate to be joined by Eric Bratberg, the director of Carnegie's Europe program based in Washington, D.C. Eric is a leading expert on European politics and security as well as transatlantic relations. Prior to joining Carnegie, Eric was the director for special projects and a senior fellow at the McCain Institute for International Leadership at Arizona State University. He's also held distinguished roles as a fellow at the German Marshall Fund, the Atlantic Council, and the Center for New American Security. Eric is originally from Sweden, but based in Washington, D.C. now with the Carnegie Endowment, works closely with the Carnegie Center in Brussels. Eric is visiting Carnegie Tsinghua Center here in Beijing this week for our Carnegie Global Dialogue Europe, and we're pleased to have him join the China and the World podcast for the first time. As part of this program this week, he's been meeting with a range of Chinese scholars, business leaders, and officials to discuss EU foreign policy and relations with China. I'm looking forward to hear his insights and perspectives on China-EU relations. So welcome to the China in the World podcast, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
There's been some discussion and a recent New York Times article, in fact, that asserts that given the contempt and distrust of Trump after being elected last year, European leaders had held out some hopes that President Xi in China would be the country and the leadership that would preserve or champion the rules and norms of a global system. This New York Times article that was published recently says that a year on, hopes have diminished, and few see China moving towards Western values embodied in democratic institutions and rule of law. Do you agree with that assertion? How do you see this?
I think there is some truth to that, Paul. I think President Xi's speech at the Davos summit in 2017 was very well received by Europeans. He seemed to advocate a multilateral trading order. He seems to defend the need to curb climate change. And of course, this came on top of the election of Donald Trump and the really immense European backlash against the new American president. But it has changed. I think the European view on China is slowly changing, especially in Western European capitals like Paris and Berlin. There's really a sense that China is not playing by the rules. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily defending multilateral trade, but it's really, you know, pursuing a much more mercantilist and sort of advocating different values and principles than sort of those of the liberal world order. So I think the European view is slowly changing, but there's still a lot of internal disagreements within Europe on how to view China and what to do about it.
I want to ask you more questions on European perceptions of China, but before I do that, the notion a year ago that you say some Europeans held out that China may play this role, I think many American analysts were very skeptical a year ago. And in fact, when President Xi gave his speech, noted a disconnect between the rhetoric and the reality of the kind of economic player China is in the global system, and saw the speech as somewhat hypocritical, saying that China is willing to play this role as champion of the global economic and trading system, yet its markets remained closed off in large part for foreign competition, you know, major issues around IPR and forced technology transfer. One analyst I talked to said, you know, it's remarkable that the Chinese leadership is saying this at Davos, because if every country in the world operated its economy like China does, the global economic and trading system would implode. And so a year ago, was this a function of wishful thinking by European leaders, or was the analysis just not there? Is it that Europe has now woken up to China, perhaps, after the 19th Party Congress and the new rhetoric around the 19th Party Congress, or was it wishful thinking.
I think there's something to that. I think Europe has a tradition of not necessarily viewing China through a strategic lens. I think traditionally European countries have viewed China almost exclusively as a commercial partner. European companies get to export to China, and there are some investments coming from China into Europe. Very few European countries have viewed it as a strategic challenge. Whereas in Washington, I think there's been this sort of emerging view over at least the past decade that China does represent a long-term strategic adversary to the United States, not just in the economic sphere, but also politically and militarily. Mm-hmm. So Europeans have not really shared that assessment, but I think it's beginning to change. And I think in some parts it has to do with China's increased assertiveness in the economic sector, but I think also some European capitals are seeing what China is doing, for instance, in the South China Sea, as being problematic when it comes to upholding rules-based international order, the Belt and Road Initiative, and what sort of values and principles that this is underpinned by. So I think you know, some of these things are beginning to inform the European debate. And then I think there's also the issue of the potential for China to have increased also political influence in Europe. China is engaging in the 16 plus one constellation of countries in Central Eastern Europe. Yeah. And some member state capitals in the European Union see this as sort of an attempt by Beijing to kind of divide and conquer you know, European countries and assert itself also politically to try to not only get more economic influence and cooperation with Europe, but also assert itself politically and get political influence.
So I want to talk about the Belt and Road in a bit. Before we get to that, I mean, it is interesting. This debate that, you know, from a strategic standpoint, as you note, has been going on for some time in the United States. And I have to often point out to my Chinese friends here in Beijing, this debate is not unique to the Trump administration. We now see the debate actually that's been happening over the last 4 or 5 years within the think tank and the academic community is now reflected in official documents, the national security strategy and defense strategy documents that have been published in the Trump administration. But this debate has actually been going on for some time in the United States. You mentioned it's fairly new in Europe, this strategic sort of view and consideration of China. What are the factors that have led to this new debate in China and this sort of re-examination of China as a global player and the China-EU interaction?
Yeah, so I think in large part, again, it's driven by economics. I think the perception in Europe that China is not playing by the books, by the rules, that their economic activities, their investments into Europe, especially in critical infrastructure, but also Chinese, you know, acquisitions of European tech companies, that these are raising not only economic concerns, but also potentially security concerns. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one aspect of kind of this growing European, in some ways, wariness of where China's going and what it means for Europe. But I think also beyond that, you know, there are concerns in Europe. And I think this is related in part also to how Europe sees the United States and the willingness of the Trump administration to, you know, continue to assume kind of the traditional U.S. global leadership role in upholding rules-based international order, that Europeans see the United States moving away from that traditional role, while at the same time they see an increasingly assertive China in its own region, but also globally, again, through, for instance, the Belt and Road Initiative. So Europeans are concerned that this is, you know, the rules-based order that they depend on is really the basis for European security, stability, and prosperity is eroding from the absence of U.S. leadership, but also from an increasingly assertive China potentially challenging some of the values, principles, and institutions underpinning that order.
So let's talk about the economic factors, because, you know, when you describe some of the concerns coming out of Europe, whether it's the kind of investments that the Chinese are making and how they're making those investments, where are they getting the resources to, you know, come in at bids for European companies at, you know, a rate much higher than other private companies can compete at, or the kind of technology that they're looking to invest in and the purposes behind investing in that technology. This, of course, resonates with me as an American looking at the U.S.-China relationship. This is obviously an issue front and center. There's moves in the United States right now to enhance our CFIUS process, the screening that we use for national security considerations on foreign investment. Market access is an issue you hear Europeans talking about much more, IPR. Of course, these are issues where we have common concern. And I wonder your views on whether or not there's potential for the U.S. and China to come together on these issues and get greater leverage in dealing with China.
Yeah, I think in principle, there's a lot of opportunity there. I think there's a lot of convergence between how the U.S. and the EU perceive China and what needs to be done to manage China's economic rise. There's a similar debate taking place in Europe right now about investment screening. We still have to see exactly where it ends up. But I think the sentiments are the same, that we need to sort of apply national security considerations when it comes to addressing inbound Chinese investments into some of these critical sectors in the West. So this is a very similar debate taking place. I think in principle, that should be the basis for a very fruitful transatlantic conversation on how to address China. And this is actually something that was reflected in the U.S. national security strategy, which talked about the need for the U.S., together with its European allies and partners, to shape a common policy on addressing some of the joint concerns that we have about China. Unfortunately, in practice, however, I think that, you know, we're, if anything, moving further apart transatlantically. And I think in large part, this is due to President Trump's decisions to take on European allies, for instance, over the latest steel and aluminum tariffs, which has Europeans very concerned about U.S. unilateral trade practices. So if anything, you know, we're not really making use of the emergence that is appearing on both sides to shape a joint approach towards China. If anything, I think we're actually drifting when it comes to putting that approach together.
It's unfortunate because, you know, in the case that you mentioned of steel and aluminum, the Article 232 cases, you know, we run the risk, depending how the decision comes out, of alienating our European friends and other allies. And, you know, frankly, China is, in terms of steel imports into the U.S., it's only about 2%. Number 11 on the list of countries in terms of the amount that they import. And so it won't really hurt China that much at the end of the day. They'll be hurt more, I think, by aluminum. But nevertheless, they'll be able to sit back to a certain extent and watch the United States fight with its allies in Europe, and then they'll be able to claim the high ground of, you know, it's the U.S. that's protectionist and we're supporting free trade and international economics.
Absolutely. It's a really, I think, a missed opportunity, but even more so, it's a self-inflicted wound that the U.S. is imposing upon itself, that is dividing the U.S. with its closest allies and partners at a time when we need, you know, deepened cooperation within the West on addressing China. So I think it's very unfortunate. And I think we're already seeing, you know, prospects for increased countermeasures from Europe to the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I think there's also the potential that Europeans will have to offset the cost of Trump's decision. Will potentially have to even impose countermeasures against China should China move to sort of, even though it's a small part of Chinese steel exports that goes to the U.S., if they need to seek an alternative market for that, then we'll sort of dump that in on the European market. I think Europeans will have to respond. And we've seen European tariffs, particularly on steel against China before. But I think the point is that these measures have been targeted. Whereas Trump's latest measure is sort of sweeping very broadly. It's not targeting China. It is hitting allies and partners. And that's undermining the potential to have a joint approach on addressing China.
So we've identified clearly common concerns between Europe and the United States in these economic and trade areas. What are the differences in how Europe and the United States look? You mentioned that, you know, America has traditionally had more of a strategic lens in looking at China. What else are there differences? Because I think it, as an American observer, you know, it's When we understand we have common concerns, that is, you know, cause for greater cooperation. But it's important to know going into these discussions with Europeans that perhaps we don't see things exactly the same.
I think that's right. I mean, I think aside from a few countries like France and the United Kingdom, very few countries have a military, European countries have a military presence in Asia or play any kind of security role in Asia. We've seen the French and the Brits actually step up their regional security role in Asia, increasing partnerships with countries like Japan and India, mm-hmm. participating, and sometimes in the case of France, even leading freedom of navigation exercises in the South China Sea. So in some capitals, you do have this sort of more strategic perception of China. But I think that's a rare situation in Europe. Mm-hmm. Again, most countries still view China through a commercial lens. And I think especially
the reason for involving it, you know, those countries, France, Germany, others, involving themselves in those issues, is it mostly about preservation of the international system and the rules and the norms?
It is, I think, to a large extent, that's what it's about. I think it's also about being useful to the United States as allies to kind of demonstrate to Washington that European countries are you know, sharing the security burden. But I was also going to say that I think for a lot of countries, especially smaller European Union member states in Southern Europe and in Central Eastern Europe, they very much still perceive China as a commercial player, an economic opportunity. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, they also perceive China as an alternative. Mm-hmm. They can claim that we have alternatives. We're getting investments and trade from China. That can send a message to the European Union in Brussels, for instance. So they can mm-hmm. use this also for their own domestic purposes or their own relationships with mm-hmm. the European Union to demonstrate that, you know, they have alternatives.
You mentioned the 16+1. Discuss a little bit the dynamics around that and how that's playing out within the European Union.
Yeah, I mean, it's an approach by China to create a constellation of countries in Central and Eastern Europe. Some of them are members of the EU, some of them like Serbia and Albania are outside of the EU. So the concern to some analysts is that this represents an approach by China to sort of divide European countries and again, try to influence not only the economics, but also the political direction mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. some of these countries. And we've seen attempts by China to kind of use some of the economic leverage, and especially in small countries that have very little alternatives when mm-hmm. it comes to FDI and investments, to try to translate that into political influence, to try to get some of these countries to be supportive of watering down, for instance, EU statements on things like the South China Sea or Chinese human rights violations or something like that. So,
you know, this is an element of what in the United States right now is a hotly debated topic around this issue of Chinese sharp power. That is the notion that using information warfare, using this kind of leverage that you talk about, the economic leverage that they have, you know, to try to shape public perception, behavior by states, statements around South China Sea, human rights, other things like that. This is hot topic in the United States, debating the kind of sharp power that we're seeing by the Chinese and, of course, the Russians and the interference in our U.S. elections. But this notion of Chinese sharp power, is this being debated in Europe? How do Europeans see this issue?
It's actually beginning to be debated in Europe. There's been a couple of articles and even reports put out by think tanks, mm-hmm. Including organizations in Germany, highlighting China's political influence and mm-hmm. the sort of, to the extent that China is also learning from the Russian playbook of how to use influence operations, how to use social media, how to play a role in financing think tanks or political parties or so forth. So there's beginning to be more consideration paid to these kind of efforts by China mm-hmm. in Europe. But I think it's still very far from the debate taking place in Europe when it comes to Russia, which I think is, to most European countries, the number one security challenge. Whereas in the United States, obviously, there's also a very lively discussion about Russia. But in terms of security priorities, it's clear that for the United States, if you read a national security strategy or the national defense strategy, China really does represent the long-term strategic challenge. Whereas in Europe, I think the security concerns are much more sort of in Europe's immediate neighborhood. It's mm-hmm. Russia in the east and its instability, you know, refugees, terrorism stemming from the southern Mediterranean that really is on top, the top priorities for European policymakers.
Yeah, the sharp power discussion around China and the U.S. is centered around the notion of Chinese trying to control discussion on sensitive issues, think tanks. You mentioned the influence on U.S. think tanks, the influence in U.S. universities, and of course we have a large number of Chinese students, the influence in Hollywood, frankly, in our movies. And so There's, I think, the risk of overreacting in the United States, but I do think it's an issue worth watching. I find it interesting that this has also become an issue in Europe.
I think Europeans are paying attention to that debate, not only in the United States, but also in other Western countries like Australia, for instance, there's been similar concerns. So I think I would expect, to the extent that those debates continue in elsewhere, I would expect that Europeans will follow those very closely and see to what extent the same types of challenges apply also closer to home.
You mentioned the 16 plus one and the different views of China as either a potential competitor or a potential economic partner. And of course, I think about the Belt and Road. And one of the big differences in the Belt and Road that was pointed out yesterday in our discussion for the U.S. and Europe is the United States is not on the Belt and Road. Mm. I think this is an interesting difference between Europe and the United States. You know, Europe, the Belt and Road goes right through Europe.
Europe is the endpoint in many ways.
Exactly. And so that, I imagine, influences the perceptions in Europe. But describe a little bit how this very ambitious initiative by the Chinese is being perceived in Europe.
I think it has been perceived mostly as an opportunity. China's bringing investments. They're building infrastructure. They're, you know, contributing to economic growth. I think that sort of has been the dominant view up until now. I think it's shifting again a little bit to be a little bit more skeptical, maybe, of China's intentions about what this amounts to.
We noticed here statements when Prime Minister May was here.
Yep.
And also out of France, the French prime minister said it has to be it can't be a one-way street.
That's right. So the European emphasis is increasingly on this needs to be something that is reciprocal, that sort of China needs to, as they're building the One Belt and Road Initiative, they need to uphold, labor standards, human rights standards, important, you know, standards and regulations that for European countries are very important. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also, you know, the flip coin is that, you know, while China is increasing its activity in Europe's periphery and even within Europe, it's still keeping its own market very closed. Mm. So I think, you know, that's another aspect that is informing and driving some of the European concerns here, that China is asserting itself, it is stepping up its activity, but it's still keeping its own market very closed for Western businesses.
Well, thank you very much, Eric, both for joining us here in China for the Carnegie Global Dialogue Europe, but also for joining us on the China in the World podcast. And we hope to have you back again several times.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thanks, Eric.
Thanks.
That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast. I encourage you to explore our site and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening. Be sure to tune in next time.